He was like that for a week before they showed up. When they finally got here, he was all sweetness and reason, but the week before was a living hell. Mr. Ice Cream was shitting in his pants. That was the week he kicked Benny Woodruff down the stairs from the third floor because he caught him with a Superman comic. Benny was out cold for 3 hours, and he couldn't quite get it straight who he was or where he was until that night. Ferd paused. He knew they were coming. Same as he always knows when the state inspectors are going to pull a surprise inspection. He hid the straitjackets in the attic and made believe the box was a hay-drying shed. Ferd's cynical, hurt laugh again. "Know what my folks did, Jack? They sent Sonny Gardner a Xerox of my letter to them. For my own good, my pop says in his next letter to me. And guess what? It's Ferd's turn in the box, courtesy of my own folks." The hurt laugh again. "Tell you one other thing. He wasn't kidding at Night Chapel. The kids that talked to the Sunday Report people all disappeared. The ones he could get hold of, anyway." The way Ferd himself has disappeared now, Jack thought, watching Wolf brood across the room. He shivered. His hands felt very, very cold. Your friend Phil, the fearless Wolf boy. Was Wolf starting to look hairier again? So soon? Surely not. But that was coming, of course. It was as relentless as the tides. "And by the way, Jack, while we're just sitting around here worrying about the dangers of just sitting around here, how's your mother? How's darling Lil, queen of the bees? Losing weight? Having pain? Is she finally starting to feel it eat into her with its sharp, ratty little teeth as you sit here growing roots in this weird prison? Is Morgan maybe getting ready to wind up the lightning and give the cancer a hand?" He had been shocked at the idea of straitjackets. And although he had seen the box, a big, ugly iron thing which sat in the home's backyard like a weird, abandoned refrigerator, he couldn't believe that Gardner actually put boys in it. Ferd had slowly convinced him, talking in a low voice as they harvested rocks in far field. "He's got a great setup here," Ferd had said. "It's a license to coin money. His religious shows play all over the Midwest on the radio and over most of the country on cable TV and the indie stations. We're his captive audience. We sound great on the radio, and we look great on the tube. When Roy Outersfeld isn't milking that fucking pimple on the end of his nose, that is. He's got Casey, his pet radio and TV producer. Casey videotapes every morning chapel and audiotapes every night chapel. He cuts all the sound and picture together and hypes everything until Gardner looks like Billy Graham and us guys sound like the crowd in Yankee Stadium during the seventh game of the World Series. That isn't all Casey does either. He's the house genius. You see the bug in your room? Casey set up the bugs. Everything feeds into his control room, and the only way into that control room is through Gardner's private office. The bugs are voice-actuated, so he doesn't waste any tape. Anything juicy, he saves for Sunlight Gardner. I've heard Casey put a blue box on Gardner's phone so he can make long-distance phone calls free, and I know damned well he spliced a line into the pay TV cable that goes by out front. You like the idea of Mr. Ice Cream settling back and watching a big double feature on Cinemax after a hard day of selling Jesus to the masses? I like it. This guy is as American as spinner hubcaps, Jack. And here in Indiana, they love him almost as much as they love high school basketball. Ferd hawked back snot, grimaced, twisted his head, and spat into the dirt. You're kidding, Jack said. Ferd Janklow never kids about the marching morons of the Sunlight Home, Ferd said solemnly. He's rich. He doesn't have to declare any of it to the Internal Revenue. He's got the local school board buffaloed. I mean, they're scared to death of him. There's this one woman who practically skitters every time she's out here. Looks like she'd like to give him the sign against the evil eye or something. And like I said, he always seems to know when someone from the State Education Board is going to pay us a surprise visit. We clean this place from top to bottom. Bass, the bastard, takes the canvas overcoats up to the attic, and the box gets filled with hay from the barn. And when they come, we're always in class. How many classes you been in since you landed here in Indiana's version of the Love Boat, Jack?
None, Jack said.
None, Ferd agreed, delighted. He laughed his cynical, hurt laugh again. That laugh said, guess what I found out when I turned 8 or so? I found out that I was getting a royal fucking from life, and that things weren't going to change in a hurry. Or maybe they were never going to change. And although it bums me out, it also has its funny side. You know what I mean, Jelly Bean? Such was the run of Jack's thoughts, When hard fingers suddenly grasped the back of his neck at the pressure points below the ears and lifted him out of his chair. He was turned around into a cloud of foul breath and treated, if that was the word, to the sterile moonscape of Heck Bast's face.
"Me and the Reverend was still in Muncie when they brought your queer troublemaker friend into the hospital," he said. His fingers pulsed and squeezed, the pain was excruciating. Jack moaned and Heck grinned.
The grin allowed bad breath to escape his mouth in even greater quantities.
"Reverend got the news on his beeper. Janklow looked like a taco that spent about 45 minutes in a microwave oven. It's gonna be a while before they put that boy back together again."
"He's not talking to me," Jack thought. "He's talking to the whole room. We're supposed to get the message that Ferd's still alive."
"You're a stinking liar," he said. "Ferd's Heck Bast hit him."
Jack went sprawling on the floor. Boys scattered away from him. From somewhere, Donnie Keegan hee-hawed. There was a roar of rage. Jack looked up, dazed, and shook his head in an effort to clear it. Heck turned and saw Wolf standing protectively over Jack, his upper lip pulled back, the overhead lights sending weird orange glints off his round glasses.
"So the dumbhead finally wants to dance," Heck said, beginning to grin. "Hey, all right, I love to dance. Come on, snotface, come on over here and let's dance."
Still growling, saliva now coating his lower lip, Wolf began to move forward. Heck moved to meet him. Chairs scraped across linoleum as people moved back hurriedly to give them room.
"What's going on here?"
From the door, Sonny Singer. No need to finish his question. He saw what was going on here. Smiling, he pulled the door shut and leaned against it, watching, arms crossed over his narrow chest, his dark, narrow face now alight. Jack switched his gaze back to Wolf and Heck.
"Wolf, be careful," he shouted. "I'll be careful, Jack," Wolf said, his voice little more than a growl. "Let's dance, asshole," Heck Bast grunted, and threw a whistling country boy roundhouse.
It hit Wolf high on the right cheekbone, driving him backward 3 or 4 steps. Donnie Keegan laughed his high, whinnying laugh, which Jack now knew was as often a signal of dismay as of glee. The roundhouse was a good, heavy blow. Under other circumstances, the fight would probably have ended right there. Unfortunately for Hector Bast, it was also the only blow he landed. He advanced confidently, big fists up at chest height, and drove the roundhouse again. This time, Wolf's arm moved upward and outward to meet it. Wolf caught Heck's fist. Heck's hand was big. Wolf's hand was bigger. Wolf's fist swallowed Heck's. Wolf's fist clenched. From within it came a sound like small, dry sticks first cracking, then breaking. Heck's confident smile first curdled, then froze solid. A moment later, he began to shriek.
"Shouldn't have hurt the herd, you bastard," Wolf whispered. "Oh, your Bible this and oh, your Bible that, Wolf. And all you have to do is hear 6 verses of the Book of Good Farming to know you never crackle, never crunch, never hurt the herd."
Heck Bast fell to his knees, howling and weeping. Wolf still held Heck's fist in his own, and Heck's arm angled up. Heck looked like a fascist giving a Heil Hitler salute on his knees. Wolf's arm was as rigid as stone, but his face showed no real effort. It was, except for the blazing eyes, almost serene. Blood began to drip out of Wolf's fist.
"Wolf, stop! That's enough!"
Jack looked around swiftly and saw that Sonny was gone, the door standing open. Almost all of the boys were on their feet now. They had drawn away from Wolf as far as the room's walls would allow, their faces awed and fearful. And still the tableau held in the center of the room, Heck Bast on his knees, arms up and out, his fist swallowed in Wolf's, blood pouring onto the floor from Wolf's fist. People crowded back into the doorway. Casey, Warwick, Sonny Singer, 3 more big guys. And Sunlight Gardner, with a small black case like a glasses case in one hand.
"That's enough," I said.
Jack took one look at the newcomers and raced toward Wolf.
"Right here and now! Right here and now!"
"All right," Wolf said quietly.
He let go of Heck's hand, and Jack saw a horrible, crushed thing that looked like a mangled pinwheel. Heck's fingers stuck off at jagged angles. Heck mewled and held his destroyed hand against his chest.
"All right, Jack."
The six of them grabbed Wolf. Wolf made a half turn, slipped one arm free, pushed, and suddenly Warwick went rattling against the wall. Someone screamed.
"Hold him!" Gardner yelled. "Hold him! Hold him, for Jesus' sake!"
He was opening the flat black case.
"No, Wolf!" Jack shouted. "Quit it!"
For a moment, Wolf went on struggling, and then he slumped back, allowing them to push him to the wall. To Jack, they looked like Lilliputians clinging to Gulliver. Sonny looked afraid of Wolf at last.
"Hold him,"
Gardner repeated, taking a glittering hypodermic out of the flat case. That mincing, almost coy smile had come onto his face.
"Hold him, praise Jesus."
"You don't need that," Jack said.
"Jack?"
Wolf looked suddenly frightened.
"Jack? Jack?"
Gardner, headed for Wolf, pushed Jack as he went by. There was good whipcord muscle in that push. Jack went reeling into Morton, who squealed and shrank away as if Jack were contaminated. Belatedly, Wolf began to struggle again, but they were six, and that was too many. Perhaps when the change was on him, it wouldn't have been.
"Jack!" he howled. "Jack! Jack!"
"Hold him, praise God," Gardner whispered, his lips skinned back brutally from his teeth, and plunged the hypodermic into Wolf's arm.
Wolf went rigid, threw his head back, and howled.
"Kill you, you bastard," Jack thought incoherently. "Kill you, kill you, kill you."
Wolf struggled and thrashed. Gardner stood back, watching coldly. Wolf got a knee up into Casey's expansive gut. Casey woofed air out, staggered backward, then came back. A minute or two later, Wolf began first to flag, then to sag. Jack got to his feet, weeping with rage. He tried to plunge toward the knot of white turtlenecks holding his friend. As he watched, he saw Casey swing a fist into Wolf's drooping face and saw blood begin to pour from Wolf's nose. Hands held him back. He struggled, then looked around and saw the frightened faces of the boys he picked rocks with in far field.
"I want him in the box," Gardner said as Wolf's knees finally buckled.
He looked slowly around at Jack.
"Unless... perhaps you'd like to tell me where we've met before, Mr. Parker."
Jack stood, looking down at his feet, saying nothing. His eyes stung and burned with hot, hateful tears.
"The box, then," Gardner said. "You may feel different when he starts to vocalize, Mr. Parker."
Gardner strode out. Wolf was still screaming in the box when Jack and the other boys were marched down to morning chapel. Sunlight Gardner's eyes seemed to dwell ironically on Jack's pale, strained face. "Perhaps now, Mr. Parker."
"Wolf, it's my mother. My mother."
Wolf was still screaming when Jack and the other boys, scheduled for field work, were split into two groups and marched out to the trucks. As he passed near the box, Jack had to suppress an urge to jam his hands over his ears. Those growls, those gibbering sobs. All at once, Sonny Singer was at his shoulder. "Reverend Gardner's in his office, waiting to take your confession right this minute, snotface," he said. "Told me to tell you he'll let the dummy out of the box the minute you tell him what he wants to know." Sonny's voice was silky, his face dangerous. Wolf, screaming and howling to be let out, pounding the home-riveted iron sides of the box with a fury of blows.
"Ah, Wolf, she's my mother."
"I can't tell him what he wants to know," Jack said.
He turned suddenly toward Sonny, turning the force of whatever had come into him in the territories upon Sonny. Sonny took two giant steps backward, his face dismayed and sickly scared. He tripped over his own feet and stumbled into the side of one of the idling trucks. If it hadn't been there, he would have fallen down.
"All right,"
Sonny said. The words came out in a breathy rush that was close to a whine.
All right, forget it."
His thin face grew arrogant again.
Reverend Gardner told me if you said no that I should tell you that your friend's screaming for you. Do you get it?
I know who he's screaming for.
Get in the truck, Peterson said grimly, barely looking at them as he passed by. But when he passed Sonny, Peterson grimaced as though he had smelled something rotten. Jack could hear Wolf screaming even after the trucks got rolling, though the mufflers on both were little more than scallops of iron lace and the engines blatted stridently. Nor did Wolf's screams fade. He had made some sort of connection with Wolf's mind now, and he could hear Wolf screaming even after the work parties had reached far field. The understanding that these screams were only in his mind did nothing at all to improve matters. Around lunchtime, Wolf fell silent, and Jack knew, suddenly and with no doubt at all, that Gardner had ordered him taken out of the box before his screams and howls attracted the wrong sort of attention. After what had happened to Ferd, he wouldn't want any attention at all focused on the Sunlight Home. When the work parties returned that late afternoon, the door of the box was standing open, and the box was empty. Upstairs, in the room they shared, Wolf was lying on the lower bunk. He smiled wanly as Jack came in.
"How's your head, Jack? Bruise looks a little better, Wolf."
"Wolf, are you all right?"
"Screamed, didn't I? Couldn't help it."
"Wolf, I'm sorry," Jack said. Wolf looked strange, too white, somehow diminished.
"He's dying," Jack thought.
"No," his mind corrected. Wolf had been dying ever since they had flipped into this world to escape Morgan. But now he was dying faster, too white, diminished. But Jack felt a creeping chill. Wolf's bare legs and arms weren't really bare. They were downed with a fine pelt of hair. It hadn't been there two nights ago. He was sure of that. He felt an urge to rush over to the window and stare out, searching for the moon, trying to make sure he hadn't somehow misplaced about 17 days.
"It's not the time of the change, Jackie," Wolf said.
His voice was dry, somehow husked out, the voice of an invalid.
"But I started to change in that dark, smelly place they put me in, Wolf. I did, because I was so mad and scared. Because I was yelling and screaming. Yelling and screaming can make the change all by themselves if a wolf does it long enough."
Wolf brushed at the hair on his legs.
"It'll go away."
"Gardner set a price for letting you out," Jack said. "But I couldn't pay it. I wanted to, but, Wolf, my mother..."
His voice blurred and wavered toward tears.
"Shh, Jackie, Wolf knows. Right here and now."
Wolf smiled his terrible, wan smile again and took Jack's hand. Chapter 24. Jack Names the Planets. Another week in the Sunlight Home, praise God. The moon put on weight. On Monday, a smiling Sunlight Gardener asked the boys to bow their heads and give thanks to God for the conversion of their brother Ferdinand Jenklo. Ferd had made a soul decision for Christ while recuperating in Parkland Hospital, Sunlight said, his smile radiant. Ferd had made a collect call to his parents and told them he wanted to be a soul winner for the Lord, and they prayed for guidance right there over the long-distance line, and his parents had come to pick him up that very day. Dead and buried under some frosty Indiana field, or over in the territories, perhaps, where the Indiana State Patrol could never go. Tuesday was too coldly rainy for fieldwork. Most of the boys had been allowed to stay in their rooms and sleep or read. But for Jack and Wolf, the period of harassment had begun. Wolf was lugging load after load of garbage from the barn and the sheds out to the side of the road in the driving rain. Jack had been set to work cleaning toilets. He supposed that Warwick and Casey, who had assigned him this duty, thought they were giving him a really nasty job to do. It was obvious that they'd never seen the men's room of the world-famous Oatly Tap. Just another week at the Sunlight Home, can you say, oh yeah?
Hector Bast returned on Wednesday, his right arm in a cast up to the elbow, his big, doughy face so pallid that the pimples on it stood out like garish dots of rouge.
"Doctor says I may never get the use of it back," Heck Bast said. "You and your numbnuts buddy have got a lot to answer for, Parker."
"You aiming to have the same thing happen to your other hand?" Jack asked him, but he was afraid. It was not just a desire for revenge he saw in Heck's eyes. It was a desire to commit murder.
"I'm not afraid of him," Heck said. "Sonny says they took most of the mean out of him in the box. Sonny says he'll do anything to keep from going back in. As for you..."
Heck's left fist flashed out. He was even clumsier with his left hand than with his right. But Jack, stunned by the big boy's pallid rage, never saw it coming. His lips spread into a weird smile under Heck's fist and broke open. He reeled back against the wall. A door opened, and Billy Adams looked out.
"Shut that door, or I'll see you get a helping," Heck screamed,
and Adams, not anxious for a dose of assault and battery, complied in a hurry. Heck started toward Jack. Jack pushed groggily away from the wall and raised his fists. Heck stopped.
"You'd like that, wouldn't you?" Heck said, "fighting with a guy that's only got one good hand."
Color rushed up into his face. Footsteps rattled on the third floor, heading toward the stairs. Heck looked at Jack.
"That's Sonny. Go on, get out of here. We're going to get you, my friend. You and the dummy both. Reverend Gardner says we can, unless you tell him whatever it is he wants to know."
Heck grinned.
"Do me a favor, snotface. Don't tell him."
They had taken something out of Wolf in the box, all right, Jack thought. 6 hours had passed since his hallway confrontation with Heck Bast. The bell for confession would ring soon, but for now Wolf was sleeping heavily in the bunk below him. Outside, rain continued to rattle off the sides of the Sunlight home. It wasn't meanness, and Jack knew it wasn't just the box that had taken it. Not even just the Sunlight home. It was this whole world. Wolf was simply pining for home. He had lost most of his vitality. He smiled rarely and laughed not at all. When Warwick yelled at him at lunch for eating with his fingers, Wolf cringed.
"It has to be soon, Jackie, because I'm dying. Wolf's dying."
Heck Bast said he wasn't afraid of Wolf, and indeed there seemed nothing left to be afraid of. It seemed that crushing Heck's hand had been the last strong act of which Wolf was capable. The confession bell rang. That night after confession and dinner and chapel, Jack and Wolf came back to their room to find both of their beds dripping wet and reeking of urine. Jack went to the door, yanked it open, and saw Sonny, Warwick, and a big lunk named Van Zant standing in the hall grinning.
"Guess we got the wrong room, Snotface," Sonny said. "Thought it had to be the toilet on account of the turds we always see floating around in there."
Van Zant almost ruptured himself, laughing at this sally. Jack stared at them for a long moment, and Van Zant stopped laughing.
"Who you looking at, turd? You want your fucking nose broke off?"
Jack closed the door, looked around, and saw Wolf asleep in his wet bunk with all his clothes on. Wolf's beard was coming back, but still his face looked pale, the skin stretched and shiny. It was an invalid's face.
"Leave him alone, then," Jack thought wearily. "If he's that tired, let him sleep in it."
"No, you will not leave him alone to sleep in that fouled bed. You will not." Tiredly, Jack went to Wolf, shook him half awake, got him off the wet, stinking mattress and out of his bibballs. They slept curled up together on the floor. At 4 in the morning, the door opened, and Sonny and Heck marched in. They yanked Jack up and half-carried him down to Sunlight Gardner's basement office. Gardner was sitting with his feet up on the corner of his desk. He was fully dressed in spite of the hour. Behind him was a picture of Jesus walking on the Sea of Galilee while his disciples gawped in wonder. To his right was a glass window looking into the darkened studio where Casey worked his idiot savant wonders. There was a heavy keychain attached to one of Gardner's belt loops. The keys, a heavy bunch of them, lay in the palm of his hand. He played with them while he spoke. "You haven't given us a single confession since you got here, Jack," Sunlight Gardener said, his tone one of mild reproof. "Confession is good for the soul. Without confession, we cannot be saved. Oh, I don't mean the idolatrous, heathenish confession of the Catholics. I mean confession before your brothers and your Savior." "I'll keep it between me and my Savior if it's all the same to you," Jack said evenly, and in spite of his fear and disorientation, he could not help relishing the expression of fury which overspread Gardner's face.
"It's not all the same to me," Gardner screamed.
Pain exploded in Jack's kidneys. He fell to his knees. "Watch what you say to Reverend Gardner, snot-face," Sonny said. "Some of us around here stand up for him."
"God bless you for your trust and your love, Sonny," Gardner said gravely, and turned his attention to Jack again. "Get up, son."
Jack managed to get up, holding on to the edge of Sunlight Gardner's expensive blonde wood desk.
"What's your real name?"
"Jack Parker." He saw Gardner nod imperceptibly and tried to turn, but it was a moment too late. Fresh pain exploded in his kidneys. He screamed and went down again, knocking the fading bruise on his forehead against the edge of Gardner's desk.
"Where are you from, you lying, impudent devil spawn of a boy?"
"Pennsylvania." Pain exploded in the meaty upper part of his left thigh. He rolled into a fetal position on the white Karistan carpet, huddled with his knees against his chest.
"Get him up."
Sonny and Heck got him up. Gardner reached into the pocket of his white jacket and took out a Zippo lighter. He flicked the wheel, produced a big yellow flame, and brought the flame slowly toward Jack's face. 9 inches, he could smell the sweet, pungent reek of lighter fluid. 6 inches, now he could feel heat. 3 inches, another inch, maybe just half that, and discomfort would turn to pain. Sunlight Gardner's eyes were hazy, happy. His lips trembled on the edge of a smile.
"Yeah," Heck's breath was hot, and it smelled like moldy pepperoni. "Yeah, do it."
"Where do I know you from?"
"I never met you before," Jack gasped.
The flame moved closer. Jack's eyes began to water, and he could feel his skin beginning to sear. He tried to pull his head back. Sonny Singer pushed it forward.
"Where have I met you?" Gardner rasped.
The lighter's flame danced deep in his black pupils, each deep spark a twinner of the other.
"Last chance!"
"Tell him, for God's sake, tell him!"
"If we ever met, I don't remember it," Jack gasped. "Maybe California."
The Zippo clicked closed. Jack sobbed with relief.
"Take him back," Gardner said.
They yanked Jack toward the door. "It won't do you any good, you know," Sunlight Gardner said. He had turned around and appeared to be meditating on the picture of Christ walking on water. "I'll get it out of you, if not tonight, then tomorrow night. If not tomorrow night, then the night after. Why not make it easy on yourself, Jack?" Jack said nothing. A moment later, he felt his arm twisted up to his shoulder blades. He moaned.
"Tell him," Sonny whispered.
And part of Jack wanted to, not because he was hurt, but because confession was good for the soul. He remembered the muddy courtyard. He remembered this same man in a different envelope of skin asking who he was. He remembered thinking, "I'll tell you anything you want to know, if only you'll stop looking at me with those freaked-out eyes of yours, sure, because I'm only a kid, and that's what kids do. They tell. They tell everything." Then he remembered his mother's voice, that tough voice, asking him if he was going to spill his guts to this guy. "I can't tell you what I don't know," he said. Gardner's lips parted in a small, dry smile.
"Take him back to his room," he said.
Just another week in the Sunlight home. Can you say amen, brothers and sisters? Just another long, long week. Jack lingered in the kitchen after the others had taken in their breakfast dishes and left. He knew perfectly well that he was risking another beating, more harassment, but by this time that seemed a minor consideration. Only 3 hours before, Sunlight Gardner had come within an ace of burning his lips off. He had seen it in the man's crazy eyes, and felt it in the man's crazy heart. After something like that, the risk of a beating seemed a very minor consideration indeed. Rudolph's cook's whites were as gray as the lowering November sky outside. When Jack spoke his name in a near whisper, Rudolph turned a bloodshot, cynical gaze on him. Cheap whiskey was strong on his breath.
"You better get out of here, new fish. They're keeping an eye on you pretty good."
"Tell me something I don't know." Jack glanced nervously toward the antique dishwasher, which thumped and hissed and gasped its steamy dragon's breath at the boys loading it. They seemed not to be looking at Jack and Rudolph, but Jack knew that "seemed" was really the operant word. Tales would be carried, oh yes. At the Sunlight home, they took away your dough, and carried tales became a kind of replacement currency.
"I need to get out of here," Jack said, "me and my big friend. How much would you take to look the other way while we went out that back door?"
"More than you could pay me, even if you could get your hands on what they took from you when they hold you in here, Buddy Roo," Rudolph said.
His words were hard, but he looked at Jack with a bleary sort of kindness. Yes, of course, it was all gone, everything. The guitar pick, the silver dollar, the big croaker marble, his $6, all gone. Sealed in an envelope and held somewhere, probably in Gardner's office downstairs. But,
look, I'd give you an IOU.
Rudolph grinned.
"Coming from someone in this den of thieves and dope addicts, that's almost funny," he said. "Piss on your fucking IOU, old hoss."
Jack turned all the new force that was in him upon Rudolph. There was a way to hide that force, that new beauty, to a degree at least. But now he let it all come out, and saw Rudolph step back from it, his face momentarily confused and amazed.
"My IOU would be good, and I think you know it," Jack said quietly.
"Give me an address and I'll mail you the cash."
"How much?"
"Fur Janklow said that for $2 you'd mail a letter for someone. Would 10 be enough to look the other way just long enough for us to take a walk?"
"Not 10, not 20, not 100, Rudolph said quietly.
He now looked at the boy with a sadness that scared Jack badly. It was that look, as much as anything else, maybe more, that told him just how badly he and Wolf were caught.
"Yeah, I've done it before. Sometimes for $5, sometimes, believe it or not, for free. I would have done it free for Ferdy Janklow. He was a good kid. These fuckers."
Rudolph raised one water and detergent reddened fist and shook it toward the green-tiled wall. He saw Morton, the accused pud-puller, looking at him, and Rudolph glared horribly at him. Morton looked away in a hurry.
"Then why not?" Jack asked desperately.
"Because I'm scared, hoss," Rudolph said.
"What do you mean?
The night I came here when Sonny started to give you some trouble, Singer..."
Rudolph flapped one hand contemptuously.
"I ain't scared of Singer, and I ain't scared of Bass, no matter how big he is. It's him I'm afraid of."
"Gardner?"
"He's a devil from hell," Rudolph said.
He hesitated and then added,
"I'll tell you something I never told nobody else. One week he was late giving me my pay envelope, and I went downstairs to his office. Most times I don't. I don't like to go down there. But this time I had to... well, I had to see a man. I needed my money in a hurry, you know what I mean? And I seen him go down the hall and into his office, so I knew he was there. I went down and knocked on the door, and it swung open when I did, because it hadn't completely latched. And you know what, kid? He wasn't there."
Rudolph's voice had lowered steadily as he told this story, until Jack could barely hear the cook over the thump and wheeze of the dishwasher. At the same time, his eyes had widened like the eyes of a child reliving a scary dream.
"I thought maybe he was in that recording studio thing they got, but he wasn't. And he hadn't gone into the chapel because there's no direct connecting door. There's a door to the outside from his office, but it was locked and bolted on the inside. So where did he go, Buddy Roo? Where did he go?"
Jack, who knew, could only look at Rudolph numbly.
"I think he's a devil from hell, and he took some weird elevator down to report to fucking HQ," Rudolph said. I'd like to help you, but I can't. There ain't enough money in Fort Knox for me to cross the Sunlight Man. Now, you get out of here. Maybe they ain't noticed you're missing.
But they had, of course. As he came out through the swinging doors, Warwick stepped up behind him and clubbed Jack in the middle of the back with hands interlaced to form one gigantic fist. As he went stumbling forward through the deserted cafeteria, Casey appeared from nowhere like an evil jack-in-the-box and stuck out a foot. Jack couldn't stop. He tripped over Casey's foot, his own feet went out from under him, and he sprawled in a tangle of chairs. He got up, fighting back tears of rage and shame.
"You don't want to be so slow taking in your dishes, snot-face," Casey said. "You could get hurt."
Warwick grinned.
"Yeah. Now get on upstairs. The trucks are waiting to leave."
At 4 the next morning, he was awakened and taken down to Sunlight Gardner's office again. Gardner looked up from his Bible as if surprised to see him. "Ready to confess, Jack Parker?"
"I have nothing."
The lighter again. The flame dancing a bare inch from the tip of his nose.
"Confess. Where have we met?"
The flame danced a little closer yet.
"I mean to have it out of you, Jack. Where? Where?"
"Saturn," Jack screamed. It was all he could think of.
"Uranus, Mercury, somewhere in the asteroid belt, Io, Ganymede."
The pain, thick and leaden and excruciating, exploded in his lower belly as Hector Bast reached between his legs with his good hand and squeezed Jack's testes.
"There," Heck Bast said, smiling cheerfully. "Didn't you just have that coming, you hell-bound mocker?"
Jack collapsed slowly to the floor, sobbing. Sunlight Gardner leaned slowly down, his face patient, almost beatific. "Next time, it will be your friend down here," Sunlight Gardner said gently. "And with him I will not hesitate. Think about it, Jack. Until tomorrow night." But tomorrow night, Jack decided, he and Wolf would not be here. If only the territories were left, then the territories it would be. If he could get them back there. Chapter 25. Jack and Wolf Go to Hell. They had to flip from downstairs. He concentrated on that, rather than on the question of whether or not they would be able to flip at all. It would be simpler to go from the room, but the miserable little cubicle he and Wolf shared was on the third floor, 40 feet above the ground. Jack didn't know how exactly the territory's geography and topography corresponded to the geography and topography of Indiana, but he wasn't going to take a chance that could get their necks broken. He explained to Wolf what they would do. "You understand?"
"Yes," Wolf said listlessly.
"Give it back to me anyway, pal.
After breakfast, I go into the bathroom across from the common room. I go into the first stall. If no one notices I'm gone, you'll come in, and we'll go back to the territories. Is that right, Jackie?"
"That's it," Jack said. He put a hand on Wolf's shoulder and squeezed it. Wolf smiled wanly. Jack hesitated and said, "I'm sorry I got you into this. It's all my fault."
"No, Jack," Wolf said kindly. "We'll try this. Maybe..."
A small, wistful hope seemed to glimmer briefly in Wolf's eyes.
"Yes," Jack said. "Maybe."
Jack was too scared and excited to want breakfast, but he thought he might attract attention by not eating. So he shoveled in eggs and potatoes that tasted like sawdust, and even managed one fatty piece of bacon. The weather had finally cleared. There had been frost the night before, and the rocks in Far Field would be like chunks of slag embedded in hardened plastic. Plates taken out to the kitchen. Boys allowed to go back to the common room while Sonny, Singer, Hector Bast, and Andy Warwick got their day rosters. They sat around, looking blank. Peterson had a fresh copy of the magazine the Gardner Organization published, The Sunlight of Jesus. He turned the pages, idly glancing up every once in a while to look at the boys. Wolf looked a question at Jack. Jack nodded. Wolf got up and lumbered from the room. Peterson glanced up, saw Wolf cross the hall and go into the long, narrow bathroom across the way, and then went back to his magazine. Jack counted to 60, then forced himself to count to 60 again. They were the longest 2 minutes of his life. He was dreadfully afraid that Sonny and Heck would come back into the common room and order all the boys out to the trucks, and he wanted to get into the bathroom before that happened. But Peterson wasn't stupid. If Jack followed Wolf too closely, Peterson might suspect something. At last Jack got up and walked across the room toward the door. It seemed impossibly far away, and his heavy feet seemed to bring him no closer. It was like an optical illusion. Peterson looked up. "Where are you going, Snotface?"
"Bathroom," Jack said.
His tongue was dry. He had heard of people's mouths getting dry when they were afraid, but their tongues? "They'll be upstairs in a minute," Peterson said, nodding toward the end of the hall, where the stairs led down to the chapel, the studio, and Gardner's office. "You better hold it in water far field."
"I gotta take a crap," Jack said desperately.
"Sure, and maybe you and your big stupid friend like to pull each other's dorks a little before you start the day, just to sort of perk yourselves up. Go sit down."
"Well, go on then," Peterson said crossly. "Don't just stand there and whine about it."
He looked back at his magazine. Jack crossed the hall and stepped into the bathroom. Wolf had picked the wrong stall. He was halfway down the line, his big, clunky work shoes unmistakable under the door. Jack pushed in. It was cramped with the two of them, and he was very aware of Wolf's strong, clearly animal odor.
"Okay," Jack said, "let's try it."
"Jack, I'm scared."
Jack laughed shakily. "I'm scared, too."
"How do we...
I don't know.
Give me your hands."
That seemed like a good start. Wolf put his hairy hands, paws almost, in Jack's hands, and Jack felt an eerie strength flow from them into him. Wolf's strength wasn't gone after all, then. It had simply gone underground, as a spring will sometimes go underground in a savagely hot season. Jack closed his eyes.
"Want to get back," he said. "Want to get back, Wolf. Help me."
"I do," Wolf breathed. "I will if I can, Wolf."
"Here and now.
Right here and now."
Jack squeezed Wolf's paw hands tighter. He could smell Lysol. Somewhere he could hear a car passing. A phone rang. He thought, "I am drinking the magic juice. In my mind, I'm drinking it right here and now. I'm drinking it. I can smell it, so purple and so thick and new. I can taste it. I can feel my throat closing on it." As the taste filled his throat, the world swayed under them, around them. Wolf cried out, "Jackie, it's working!" It startled him out of his fierce concentration, and for a moment he became aware that it was only a trick, like trying to get to sleep by counting sheep, and the world steadied again. The smell of the Lysol flooded back. Faintly, he heard someone answer the phone querulously. "Yes, hello, who is it?"
"Never mind. It's not a trick. Not a trick at all. It's magic. It's magic, and I did it before when I was little, and I can do it again. Speedy said so. That blind singer Snowball said so, too. The magic juice is in my mind."
He bore down with all his force, all his effort of will, and the ease with which they flipped was stupefying, as if a punch aimed at something which looked like granite hit a cleverly painted papier-mâché shell instead, so that the blow you thought would break all your knuckles instead encountered no resistance at all. To Jack, with his eyes screwed tightly shut, it felt as if the floor had first crumbled under his feet and then disappeared completely. "Oh, shit, we're gonna fall anyway," he thought dismally. But it wasn't really a fall, only a minor sideslip. A moment later, he and Wolf were standing firmly, not on hard bathroom tile, but on dirt. A reek of sulfur mingled with what smelled like raw sewage flooded in. It was a deathly smell, and Jack thought it meant the end of all hope.
"Jason, what's that smell?" Wolf groaned. "Oh, Jason, that smell! Can't stay here, Jackie. Can't stay..."
Jack's eyes snapped open. At the same moment, Wolf let go of Jack's hands and blundered forward, his own eyes still tightly shut. Jack saw that Wolf's ill-fitting chinos and checked shirt had been replaced by the Oshkosh bibballs in which Jack had originally seen the big herdsman. The John Lennon glasses were gone, and Wolf was blundering toward the edge of a precipice less than 4 feet away.
Wolf!
He lunged at Wolf and wrapped his arms around Wolf's waist.
Wolf, no! Jackie, can't stay, Wolf moaned. It's a pit, one of the pits. Morgan made these places. Oh, I heard that Morgan made them. I can smell it. Wolf, there's a cliff. You'll fall.
Wolf's eyes opened. His jaw dropped as he saw the smoky chasm which spread at their feet. In its deepest, cloudy depths, red fire winked like infected eyes.
A pit, Wolf moaned. Oh, Jackie, it's a pit. Furnaces of the Black Heart down there. Black Heart at the middle of the world. Can't stay, Jackie. It's the worst bad there is.
Jack's first cold thought as he and Wolf stood at the edge of the pit looking down into hell or the Black Heart at the middle of the world was that Territory's geography and Indiana geography weren't the same. There was no corresponding place in the Sunlight Home to this cliff, this hideous pit. 4 feet to the right, Jack thought with a sudden sickening horror. That's all it would have taken, just 4 feet to the right. And if Wolf had done what I told him... If Wolf had done just what Jack had told him, they would have flipped from that first stall. And if they had done that, they would have come into the territories just over this cliff's edge. The strength ran out of his legs. He groped at Wolf again, this time for support. Wolf held him absently, his eyes wide and glowing a steady orange. His face was a grue of dismay and fear.
It's a pit, Jackie.
It looked like the huge open pit molybdenum mine he had visited with his mother when they had vacationed in Colorado 3 winters ago. They had gone to Vail to ski, but one day it had been too bitterly cold for that, and so they had taken a bus tour to the Continental Minerals molybdenum mine outside the little town of Sidewinder. "It looks like Gehenna to me, Jacko," she had said, and her face as she looked out the frost-bordered bus window had been dreamy and sad. "I wish they'd shut those places down, every one of them. They're pulling fire and destruction out of the earth. It's Gehenna, all right." Thick, choking vines of smoke rose from the depths of the pit. Its sides were veined with thick loads of some poisonous green metal. It was perhaps half a mile across. A road leading downward spiraled its inner circumference. Jack could see figures toiling both upward and downward upon this road. It was a prison of some kind, just as the Sunlight Home was a prison, and these were the prisoners and their keepers. The prisoners were naked, harnessed in pairs to carts like rickshaws, carts filled with huge chunks of that green, greasy-looking ore. Their faces were drawn in rough woodcuts of pain. Their faces were blackened with soot. Their faces ran with thick red sores. The guards toiled beside them, and Jack saw with numb dismay that they were not human. In no sense at all could they be called human. They were twisted and humped, their hands were claws, their ears pointed like Mr. Spock's. Why, they're gargoyles, he thought. All those nightmare monsters on those cathedrals in France. Mom had a book, and I thought we were going to have to see everyone in the whole country. But she stopped when I had a bad dream and wet the bed. Did they come from here? Did somebody see them here? Somebody from the Middle Ages who flipped over, saw this place, and thought he'd had a vision of hell? But this was no vision. The gargoyles had whips, and over the rumble of the wheels and the sounds of rock cracking steadily under some steady baking heat, Jack heard their pop and whistle. As he and Wolf watched, one team of men paused very near the top of the spiral road, their heads down, tendons on their necks standing out in harsh relief, their legs trembling with exhaustion. The monstrosity who was guarding them, a twisted creature with a breech clout twisted around its legs and a patchy line of stiff hair growing from the scant flesh over the knobs of its spine, brought its whip down first on one and then on the other, howling at them in a high, screeching language that seemed to drive silver nails of pain into Jack's head. Jack saw the same silver beads of metal that had decorated Osmond's whip, and before he could blink, the arm of one prisoner had been torn open, and the nape of the other's neck lay in ruined flaps. The men wailed and leaned forward even farther, their blood the deepest color in the yellowish murk. The thing screeched and gibbered, and its grayish-plated right arm flexed as it whirled the whip over the slaves' heads. With a final staggering jerk, they yanked the cart up and onto the level. One of them fell forward onto his knees, exhausted, and the forward motion of the cart knocked him sprawling. One of the wheels rolled over his back. Jack heard the sound of the downed prisoner's spine as it broke. It sounded like a track referee's starter gun. The gargoyle shrieked with rage as the cart tottered and then fell over, dumping its load onto the split, cracked, arid ground at the top of the pit. He reached the fallen prisoner in two lunging steps and raised his whip. As he did, the dying man turned his head and looked into Jack Sawyer's eyes. It was Ferd Janklow. Wolf saw too. They groped for each other. And flipped back. They were in a tight, closed place, a bathroom stall, in fact, and Jack could barely breathe because Wolf's arms were wrapped around him in a crushing embrace, and one of his feet was sopping wet. He had somehow managed to flip back with one foot in a toilet bowl. Oh, great. Things like this never happened to Conan the Barbarian, Jack thought dismally.
"Jack, no! Jack, no! The pit! It was the pit! No, Jack! Quit it! Quit it, Wolf! We're back! No! No!"
Wolf broke off. He opened his eyes slowly.
"Back? You bet. Right here and now, so let go of me. You're breaking my ribs. And besides, my foot's stuck in the damn..."
The door between the bathroom and the hall burst open with a bang. It struck the inner tile wall with enough force to shatter the frosted glass panel. The stall door was torn open. Andy Warwick took one look and spoke three furious, contemptuous words.
"You fucking queers!"
He grabbed the dazed Wolf by the front of his checked shirt and pulled him out. Wolf's pants caught on the steel hood over the toilet paper dispenser and pulled the whole works off the wall. It went flying. The toilet paper roll broke free and went unspooling across the floor. Warwick sent Wolf crashing into the sinks, which were just the right height to catch him in the privates. Wolf fell to the floor, holding himself. Warwick turned to Jack, and Sonny Singer appeared at the stall door. He reached in and grabbed Jack by the front of his shirt.
"All right, you fat—"
Sonny began, and that was as far as he got. Ever since he and Wolf had been dragooned into this place, Sonny Singer had been in Jack's face. Sonny Singer, with his sly, dark face that wanted to look just like Sunlight Gardner's face, and as soon as it could. Sonny Singer, who had coined the charming endearment Snotface. Sonny Singer, whose idea it had undoubtedly been to piss in their beds. Jack pistoned his right fist out, not swinging wildly in the Heck Bast style, but driving strong and smooth from the elbow. His fist connected with Sonny's nose. There was an audible crunch. Jack felt a moment of satisfaction so perfect it was sublime. "There!" Jack cried. He pulled his foot out of the john. A great grin suffused his face, and he shot a thought at Wolf just as hard as he could. "We ain't doing that bad, Wolf. You broke one bastard's hand, and I broke one bastard's nose." Sonny stumbled backward, screaming, blood spouting through his fingers. Jack came out of the stall, his fists held up in front of him, in a pretty fair imitation of John L. Sullivan. "I told you to watch out for me, Sonny. Now I'm going to teach you to say hallelujah."
"Heck!" Sonny screamed. "Andy! Casey! Somebody!"
"Sonny, you sound scared," Jack said. "I don't know why," and then something. Something that felt like a full hod of bricks fell on the back of his neck, driving him forward into one of the mirrors over the sinks. If it had been glass, it would have broken and cut Jack badly. But all the mirrors here were polished steel. There were to be no suicides in the Sunlight Home. Jack was able to get one arm up and cushion the blow a little, but he still felt woozy as he turned around and saw Heck Bast grinning at him. Heck Bast had hit him with the cast on his right hand. As he looked at Heck, an enormous, sickening realization suddenly dawned on Jack. It was you. That hurt like hell, Heck said, holding his plastered right hand in his left. But it was worth it, Snotface. He started forward. It was you. It was you standing over Ferd in that other world, whipping him to death. It was you. You were the gargoyle. It was your twinner. A rage so hot it was like shame swept through Jack. As Heck came in range, Jack leaned back against the sink, grasped its edge tightly in both hands, and shot both of his feet out. They caught Heck Bast squarely in the chest and sent him reeling back into the open stall. The shoe that had come back to Indiana planted in a toilet bowl left a clear wet print on Heck's white turtleneck sweater. Heck sat down in the toilet with a splash, looking stunned. His cast clunked on porcelain. Others were bursting in now. Wolf was trying to get up. His hair hung in his face. Sonny was advancing on him, one hand still clapped over his squirting nose, obviously meaning to kick Wolf back down. "Yeah, you go ahead and touch him, Sonny," Jack said softly, and Sonny cringed away. Jack caught one of Wolf's arms and helped him up. He saw, as if in a dream, that Wolf had come back hairier than ever. "It's putting him under too much stress, all of this. It's bringing on his change. And Christ, this is never going to end. Never, never." He and Wolf backed away from the others, Warwick, Casey, Peterson, Peabody, Singer, and toward the rear of the bathroom. Heck was coming out of the stall Jack had kicked him into, and Jack saw something else. They had flipped from the fourth stall down the line. Heck Bast was coming out of the fifth. They had moved just far enough in that other world to come back into a different stall.
"They was buggering each other in there," Sonny cried, his words muffled and nasal. "The retard and the pretty boy. Warwick and me caught him with their dicks out."
Jack's buttocks touched cold tile. Nowhere else to run. He let go of Wolf, who slumped, dazed and pitiful, and put up his fists. "Come on," he said. "Who's first?"
"You gonna take us all on?" Peterson asked.
"If I have to, I will," Jack said. "What are you going to do, put me in traction for Jesus? Come on." A flicker of unease on Peterson's face, a cramp of outright fear on Casey's. They stopped. They actually stopped. Jack felt a moment of wild, stupid hope. The boys stared at him with the unease of men looking at a mad dog which can be brought down, but which may bite someone badly first.
"Stand aside, boys," a powerful, mellow voice said, and they moved aside willingly, relief lighting their faces. It was Reverend Gardner. Reverend Gardner would know how to handle this. He came toward the cornered boys, dressed this morning in charcoal slacks and a white satin shirt with full, almost Byronic sleeves. In his hand he held that black hypodermic case. He looked at Jack and sighed.
"Do you know what the Bible says about homosexuality, Jack?" Jack bared his teeth at him. Gardner nodded sadly as if this were no more than he had expected.
"Well, all boys are bad," he said. "It's axiomatic." He opened the case. The hypo glittered. "I think that you and your friend have been doing something even worse than sodomy, however," Gardner went on in his mellow, regretful voice, "going to places better left to your elders and betters, perhaps."
Sonny Singer and Hector Bast exchanged a startled, uneasy look.
"I think that some of this evil, this perversity, has been my own fault." He took the hypo out, glanced at it, and then took out a vial. He handed the case to Warwick and filled the hypo.
I have never believed in forcing my boys to confess. But without confession there can be no decision for Christ, and with no decision for Christ, evil continues to grow. So, although I regret it deeply, I believe that the time to ask has ended, and the time to demand in God's name has come. Peterson, Peabody, Warwick, Casey, hold them. The boys surged forward on his command like trained dogs. Jack got in one blow at Peabody, and then his hands were grabbed and pinned.
"Let me hit him,"
Sonny cried in his new muffled voice. He elbowed through the crowd of goggling boys, his eyes glittering with hate.
"I want to hit him."
"Not now," Gardner said. "Later, perhaps. We'll pray on it, won't we, Sonny?"
"Yeah."
The glitter in Sonny's eyes had become positively feverish.
"I'm going to pray on it all day."
Like a man who is finally waking up after a very long sleep, Wolf grunted and looked around. He saw Jack being held, saw the hypodermic needle, and peeled Peterson's arm off Jack as if it had been the arm of a child. A surprisingly strong roar came from his throat.
"No! Let him go!"
Gardner danced in toward Wolf's blind side with a fluid grace that reminded Jack of Osmond turning on the carter in that muddy stable yard. The needle flashed and plunged. Wolf wheeled, bellowing as if he had been stung, which in a way was just what had happened to him. He swept a hand at the hypo, but Gardner avoided the sweep neatly. The boys, who had been looking on in their dazed sunlight home way, now began to stampede for the door, looking alarmed. They wanted no part of big, simple Wolf in such a rage.
"Let him go! Let him! Let him! Wolf! Jack! Jackie!"
Wolf looked at him with puzzled eyes that shifted like strange kaleidoscopes from hazel to orange to a muddy red. He held his hairy hands out to Jack, and then Hector Bast stepped up behind him and clubbed him to the floor.
"Wolf! Wolf!"
Jack stared at him with wet, furious eyes.
"If you killed him, you son of a bitch!"
"Shh, Mr. Jack Parker," Gardner whispered in his ear, and Jack felt the needle sting his upper arm. "Just be quiet now. We're going to get a little sunlight in your soul. And maybe then we'll see how you like pulling a loaded wagon up the spiral road. Can you say hallelujah?" That one word followed him down into dark oblivion. Hallelujah. 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 Chapter 26. Wolf in the Box. Jack was awake for quite a long time before they knew he was awake. But he became aware of who he was and what had happened and what his situation was now only by degrees. He was in a way like the soldier who has survived a fierce and prolonged artillery barrage. His arm throbbed where Gardner had punched the hypodermic into it. His head ached so badly that his very eyeballs seemed to pulse. He was ragingly thirsty. He advanced a step up the ladder of awareness when he tried to touch the hurt place on his upper right arm with his left hand. He couldn't do it. And the reason he couldn't do it was that his arms were somehow wrapped around himself. He could smell old, moldy canvas. It was the smell of a Boy Scout tent found in an attic after many dark years. It was only then, although he had been looking at it stupidly through his mostly lidded eyes for the last 10 minutes, that he understood what he was wearing. It was a straitjacket. Ferd would have figured that out quicker, Jacko, he thought, and thinking of Ferd had a focusing effect on his mind in spite of the crushing headache. He stirred a little, and the bolts of pain in his head and the throb in his arm made him moan. He couldn't help it. Heck, Bast, he's waking up. Sunlight Gardner, no, he's not. I gave him a shot big enough to paralyze a bull alligator. He'll be out until 9 tonight at the earliest. He's just dreaming a little.
Heck, I want you to go up and hear the boys' confessions tonight. Tell them there will be no night chapel, I've got a plane to meet, and that's just the start of what's probably going to be a very long night. Sonny, you stay and help me do the bookwork. Heck, it sure sounded like he was waking up. Sunlight, go on, Hack, and have Bobby Peabody check on Wolf. Sonny, snickering,
he doesn't like it in there much, does he?
Ah, Wolf, they put you back in the box, Jack mourned. I'm sorry, my fault. All of this is my fault. The hellbound rarely care much for the machinery of salvation, Jack heard Sunlight Gardner say. When the devils inside them start to die, they go out screaming. Go on now, Hack.
Yes, sir, Reverend Gardner.
Jack heard but did not see Hack as he lumbered out. He did not as yet dare to look up. Stuffed into the crudely made, home-welded and home-bolted box like a victim of premature burial in an iron coffin, Wolf had howled the day away, battering his fists bloody against the sides of the box, kicking with his feet at the double-bolted Dutch oven-type door at the coffin's foot until the jolts of pain traveling up his legs made his crotch ache. He wasn't going to get out battering with his fists or kicking with his feet, he knew that, just as he knew they weren't going to let him out just because he screamed to be let out. But he couldn't help it. Wolf's hated being shut up above all things. His screams carried through the Sunlight Home's immediate grounds and even into the near fields. The boys who heard them glanced at each other nervously and said nothing.
"I seen him in the bathroom this morning, and he turned mean," Roy Outersfeld confided to Morton in a low, nervous voice.
"Was they queerin' off, like Sonny said?" Morton asked.
Another wolf howl rose from the squat iron box, and both boys glanced toward it.
"And how?" Roy said eagerly. "I didn't exactly see it because I'm short, but Buster Oates was right up front, and he said that big retarded boy had him a wanger the size of an Akron fire plug. That's what he said."
"Jesus," Morton said respectfully, thinking perhaps of his own substandard wanger. Wolf howled all day, but as the sun began to go down, he stopped. The boys found the new silence ominous. They looked at one another often, and even more often, and with more unease, toward that rectangle of iron standing in the center of a bald patch in the home's backyard. The box was 6 feet long and 3 feet high. Except for the crude square cut in the west side and covered with heavy-gauge steel mesh, an iron coffin was exactly what it looked like. What was going on in there, they wondered. And even during confession, during which time the boys were usually held rapt, every other consideration forgotten, eyes turned toward the common room's one window, even though that window looked on the side of the house directly opposite the box. What's going on in there? Hector Bass knew that their minds were not on confession, and it exasperated him, but he was unable to bring them around because he did not know what precisely was wrong. A feeling of chilly expectation had gripped the boys in the home. Their faces were paler than ever. Their eyes glittered like the eyes of dope fiends. What's going on in there? What was going on was simple enough. Wolf was going with the moon. He felt it happen as the patch of sun coming in through the ventilation square began to rise higher and higher, as the quality of the light became reddish. It was too early to go with the moon. She was not fully pregnant yet, and it would hurt him. Yet it would happen, as it always happened to wolves eventually, in season or out of it, when they were pressed too long and too hard. Wolf had held himself in check for a long time because it was what Jackie wanted. He had performed great heroisms for Jack in this world. Jack would dimly suspect some of them, yet never come close to apprehending their incredible depth and breadth. But now he was dying, and he was going with the moon. And because the latter made the former seem more than bearable, almost holy and surely ordained, Wolf went in relief and in gladness. It was wonderful not to have to struggle any more. His mouth, suddenly deep with teeth. After Heck left, there were office sounds. The soft scrape of chairs being moved, a jingle of the keys on Sunlight Gardner's belt, a file cabinet door running open and then closed. Abelson, $240.36. Sounds of keys being punched. Peter Abelson was one of the boys on OS. Like all of the OS boys, he was bright, personable, and had no physical defects. Jack had seen him only a few times, but he thought Abelson